I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Barack Obama's candidacy has raised a host of issues surrounding race in America. To help address some of those issues, we have Dr. Camille Charles. Camille is the director of the Center for Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. She's here to talk with us about how race has played a role this political season. While Dr. Charles is studying the language we use around race, Lindsay Zaltman has written a book about the language we use about what we buy. He's the co-author of the book, Marketing Metaphoria, about the use of language and how a powerful metaphor can be used to change perceptions of a candidate or a city. Plus, our producer, Scotty Iseri, introduces us to an artist whose day job provides him with a unique source of inspiration. Plus, our regular contributors, Nate Berg and Walker Smith, today on Smart City, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Our first guest, Dr. Camille Charles, is the director of the Center for Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. She's written extensively on race, class, and society, and she's with us today to talk to us about the language we use about race, specifically within the context of the Obama presidential campaign. Camille, you've been studying the black experience in America for many years. What does it mean that we now have a man whose father was a black African running for president?
I think for the average black American, it really doesn't matter whether his father was from Kenya or from Atlanta or somewhere in the United States. Probably most especially because his father wasn't around, and so his and he didn't grow up in Africa, and so his Barack Obama's experience is an American black experience in terms of the way that the rest of the country responds to him, the way that that will then shape his own worldview and perspective. But the other thing I think to keep in mind is that the black community or the black population in the United States has always been one that is very much open-armed, so to speak. And so we sort of claim everybody who looks like us and wants to be a part of our community. And in fact, sometimes even when individuals themselves aren't necessarily clear on that. So if you take somebody like Tiger Woods, who doesn't identify as black himself, he identifies as what he calls Cablasian. But, you know, among blacks, he is seen as one of them, one of our community.
What do you think it means to Barack Obama's experience, not as people view him, but as he views the world, having grown up in a place where there were not many black Americans?
I think there are two things that play into that. One is that he grew up in a place that didn't have many black Americans. The other is that he himself is biracial and was raised by the white side of his family, and he doesn't look like them. You know, and I think that's something that more than a few blacks can relate to, and certainly I can relate to that. I'm biracial. I was raised in a neighborhood where we were the only non-white people for miles. And so in terms of that, it puts you in a really interesting position because you really understand, I think, both sides of the racial divide, if that's what you want to call it, so that you get a more intimate understanding of white America and their beliefs, their stereotypes, their fears, and the way that they think through these things more generally. At the same time, that you also understand your own place in that world and that irrespective of your family composition and your day-to-day experiences within that family, that much of your so-called place in the world is determined by the way others perceive you and not the way that you perceive yourself. And so I do think that gives him a perspective that is different from a monoracial African-American who understands that but often doesn't have the same kind of regular contact and intimate contact with whites.
Do you think that the fact that he is running for president means that race will now play a lesser role in American life?
No. It may change the role that race plays, or it may begin to change the role that race plays. Something that I think we haven't thought about so much is that traditionally in American society, African Americans are thought of as a group or as a collectivity. And so quite often the accomplishments and also the failures of one individual often cast a shadow back on the population as a whole. So to some extent, yes, his successes will reflect positively. At the same time, though, one of the things we have to do in order to be able to vote for him is to think of him as an individual. So if you think about the sort of disaffected Hillary Clinton voters who are still saying, well, you know, I'm just not quite sure if I know enough about him, if he really is who he says he is, those kinds of feelings are often, but not always, indicative of some underlying racial discomfort that is still very much a part of the American psyche. More than 50% of whites still adhere to negative stereotypes about blacks, still view African Americans as undeserving of some of the advances that they've made, particularly if it's felt that those advances have been made by way of government intervention, whether it's affirmative action or other kinds of policies. Because we are becoming more egalitarian in our principles, it's become more difficult to talk about these persisting attitudes. And so if we come to see Barack Obama as an individual, as a single man who is running for president, and then are able to vote for him because we think that his agenda for the country is the one that is best suited for our universal success as well as our individual lives, then what we will have succeeded in doing is getting the American public to see him as an individual, which I think is very important. However, we can grow to love Barack Obama as an individual and not really see our attitudes about black people more generally change at all.
Well, you said something that continues to both fascinate and perplex me, and that is the stereotypes that we hold and how we understand whether it's a stereotype at work or whether, in fact, it's just, I don't agree with the guy. I don't like the guy. Indeed, I don't know enough about the guy. I mean, you pointed to Hillary Clinton voters who say, for instance, some of whom say, we just don't know enough about him. And how is it that we parse through that, Camille, and separate, you know, what is indeed a stereotype and what, in fact, is a legitimate opinion?
One way to think about it is this. I think that there has been a concerted effort to cast Barack Obama as anti-American. Okay? There's a lot of survey research showing quite strongly that we equate being American with being white. So that from the starting gate, when we look at people of color, on average, we tend to think of them as being less American than we do when we look at whites. And so in any regular effort to discredit any opposition candidate, we're going to draw on what works for us. One of the things that I think has been somewhat successful is this casting of Barack Obama as somehow less American, whether it's because of his last name or it's because of where his father is from, or it's because he doesn't wear a flag pin. Well, consistently, for example, during the primary season, other candidates didn't wear flag pins either. And it wasn't an issue. No one ever questioned their patriotism. John McCain, for example, in the debate the other night, didn't wear a flag pin. It's never been a question of his patriotism. It's when we start to attach, I think, greater meaning to these kinds of things with a person who doesn't fit that traditional stereotype of an American, or when we cannot say that our discomfort is a function of policy differences. So for someone who is an independent, but say traditionally has leaned Republican, that feeling of nagging discomfort, you know, you can also say, well, I've never really gravitated toward the Democratic Party platform anyway. But when you're talking about candidates where the policy differences are minuscule between, say, a Hillary Clinton and a Barack Obama, but they are huge when you talk about the difference between a Barack Obama and a John McCain. I think that's when we have to at least start to think about and to seriously consider the role that race continues to play in American racial politics and in the American psyche more generally. And I'm not saying, you know, it's not something that we do consciously. So this is not a case where we're thinking that those individuals who are expressing that kind of nagging discomfort that they can't put their finger on as, you know, suggesting that those people are all bigots and that they know they're bigots. That's not at all what I'm suggesting, because what's happening is the remnants of racism and prejudice in America are becoming more and more subconscious. We're working harder and harder at fighting them, I think. And so what you're talking about are sort of subtle differences and the comfort with sort of falling back on age-old attitudes in our country. So that, you know, again, it's not the Jim Crow kind of racism that I'm talking about here. There are plenty of wonderful, well-meaning people who may really unknowingly have been falling back on these attitudes. And in fact, when you have a conversation with them and kind of draw them out, they can look at it and say, wow, you know, maybe I haven't been able to give him a fair shot. And really a lot of the problem is that we don't have a healthy environment for having a realistic conversation about race in our country at this point.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Camille Charles at the University of Pennsylvania. We're talking about Barack Obama's presidential campaign and how it has illuminated the way we talk about race in America. You teach at the University of Pennsylvania, and so certainly you are in contact all the time with young people, perhaps an elite group of young people, and I mean that in the best possible way, some outstanding achievers. But I'm curious, Camille, do you in fact see a change in racial attitudes among young people in college today from their parents and certainly I would think their grandparents, but even their parents? I'm kind of curious what you see in a younger generation.
I see some change in some ways, and I see more of the same in others. So, for example, I think for college-age adults, seeing a black candidate is not that big a deal. It's sort of the natural progression of things in their minds. Somebody being biracial is far less of a big deal for them because they know more biracial people, because there are, you know, in their generation, there are far more biracial individuals than there are from, say, my generation. And, you know, I'm only a few years younger than Senator Obama. So, you know, it's become much more commonplace to see mixed race people and to see them in positions of power and authority. And for this group, that's sort of just the way things would progress. And it's evidence of our becoming this sort of fully participatory country that we're meant to be. This is a generation of young people who are much less well in touch with the civil rights movement, the civil rights era, and all that went on in that, and are sort of under the understanding that we've moved past that. At the same time, many of these students adhere to some of the same negative stereotypes that I was talking about earlier. And this is what I'm saying. It's become much more complicated. So they can at once see this as the natural progression of things, the way things ought to be, to embrace that and be excited by it, while at the same time adhering to negative stereotypes about blacks' intellectual ability, about their work ethic, and all of the other traditional stereotypes that have persisted since, you know, blacks were first brought to the United States as slaves.
What does research tell us about what stereotypes affect behavior of those who are stereotyped?
I think what we know best is that, for example, with respect to academic performance, simply knowing that my group is stereotyped as less intelligent can be enough to stunt my performance on a standardized test. They have found this to be true for African Americans compared to whites. They have found this to be true for women in math and science. They've done these experiments comparing so-called thinking athletes, golfers or quarterbacks, for example, compared to those who are supposed to have just more natural athletic ability, say running backs, defensive backs in football. So we know that any social identity that has a stereotype attached to it of intellectual inferiority can see their performance stunted simply by being aware that the stereotype exists and being put in a position to have to refute that stereotype. It's not so much that those groups internalize those beliefs, though that can happen too, because it doesn't matter under this circumstance whether the individual believes the stereotype or not. It's simply knowing that others believe it. And again, if I succeed, I am succeeding not only as an individual, but it ends up reflecting positively on my group because I am contradicting that stereotype. But if I fail, I'm not failing as an individual. I'm also now living up to that stereotype of my group. And that's a heavy burden to shoulder.
Well, absolutely. Now, we've been talking about racial stereotypes, but race is not the only source of stereotypes. I mean, many of us have stereotypes around weight, around gender. You mentioned gender, sexual orientation, the part of the country you're from. I know about these stereotypes. I'm sure there are others. In fact, they really seem quite prevalent. Are all of these as harmful as racial stereotypes, or does race somehow stand out as particularly destructive?
I think for some, race stands out as particularly destructive in part because of our racial legacy. You know, no one would argue about women having been oppressed in this country, nor that they continue to suffer from discrimination, right? They don't get paid the same amount of money for equal work. The role that they play in raising families is diminished. And yet, I think the racial stereotype stands out as special because blacks were singularly labeled as less than a full human being legally at one point in our history. They were slaves and property. And they had their rights and opportunities constrained by rule of law, you know, up until the mid-1960s with the passage of the Fair Housing and Civil Rights legislation that really made it rule of law that African Americans had equal opportunities in terms of political participation, in terms of the labor market, in terms of education, in terms of all of those things. We didn't really get serious about enforcing all of that until 1964, 1965, 1968. And in fact, despite the passage of those laws, we find too much evidence of persisting discrimination against African Americans in the labor market and in the housing market. This is not to say that we don't continue to find gender bias, because we do. And in fact, single mothers with children often have a very difficult time securing housing, for example, and can have a hard time getting jobs because it's figured that they'll be less reliable since they are the only ones taking care of the children. So I don't like to compare pain, but I think that what makes the racial issue one that persists and that is much more difficult for us to talk about is the legacy of slavery and segregation. But also, I think that, you know, these things have become much more difficult to put our fingers on in terms of proving it. Gender discrimination will get a little bit more attention and will be easier to eliminate, in part because women end up attached to men and families. We need two incomes. And so what may have once only been women's issues are really becoming, you know, men's issues as well. We still believe that blacks' issues are not whites' issues, which is unfortunate and untrue. And so, again, you get voters in certain areas of the country saying that they really just believe that white people look out for white people and black people look out for black people. And Barack Obama is black, so he's not going to be looking out for me. Still clinging to these age-old stereotypes that I think are almost part of our DNA as a country, none of us fully escapes them.
we will live with those legacies of slavery and segregation forever. They are legacies. We can't get rid of those. So in the face of our history, how do we, once and for all, rid ourselves of these stereotypes, or is that simply too ambitious a goal?
I would like to think that several generations from now we could rid ourselves of them. I think, you know, part of what's missing really is an honest and frank conversation.
But how do you get the right people to the table? It always strikes me that conversations about race, I mean, the only people who, and certainly if it requires coming to a table, my God, you know, the only people who want to come to the table are the people who in some ways don't need to be at the table. I mean, you know what I'm saying. I mean, it's like the people who ought to be at the table are never there because they have racial stereotypes. So how do you have this conversation productively? It seems to me that it's always a kind of a, I don't know, what do I say, touchy-feely, hold hands, I don't know. How do you have this conversation productively with the people who ought to be at the table?
Well, there are several structural or institutional things that could help that along. You know, it hasn't been that long that we teach our children accurate American history, for example. So, you know, when I was in high school, American history was really Euro-centered. We spent one day talking about the Civil War and Abraham Lincoln and how wonderful he was. And we spent one day talking about the Civil Rights Movement. And in that discussion, Martin Luther King Jr. was wonderful and Malcolm X was awful. And so we really didn't start even considering a more balanced teaching of American history and thinking about Black history, for example, as part of American history rather than pigeonholing it into something you do in February. This is really recent, and I'm not sure how widespread it is in our public schools. I mean, I live in Philadelphia, and I know that in Philadelphia, to graduate from high school, you have to learn African American history. But I think that's fairly new. One way to start to move past this is for all of us to learn about our history, not only from the perspective of the founding fathers and their descendants, but also from the perspective of those who were conquered, who were enslaved, who saw their rights minimized or stripped from them altogether. So that we also don't learn, to my mind, about women's history in the way that we should, to really understand the issues that are important to women and why it might be that women still suffer discrimination in the labor market in particular, but, you know, why women's work remains devalued in the way that it is. So, I mean, that is one thing that could happen structurally, institutionally, that would then change the kinds of conversations that we have around our kitchen tables with our families, but also then it would change our worldview and our perspective as we go out into the world of work, which is why I think college students really do understand this and get it in a way that older generations don't. Because they are starting to get more of that. We're just starting to see a subpopulation of the United States that is more inclined to have gotten those kinds of educational experiences. So, I mean, I think that can do a lot. But I also think you do need to see elected officials from the president on down stressing the importance of having these kinds of conversations and the importance of doing things to reduce gender gaps in education and in earnings and in occupational prestige, racial gaps in those kinds of things, continuing to push for equal rights for people, for gays and lesbians, and really starting to promote those kinds of conversations from the top down, because we do really pay attention to what our leaders are doing. And we do fall into line and start to change our own behavior, or at least to think about alternative perspectives as a consequence. And in fact, I've gotten really interesting emails from people who see my comments in the paper, for example, and maybe don't agree with me initially, but they want to ask me more questions. And we have to be willing to answer those questions, even if we think they're insensitive. If somebody gets up the nerve to ask the question, we have to feel like we will take the time to answer them, because if they're asking the question, they really want to know.
Camille, this has been a really interesting discussion. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Camille Charles is the director of the Center for Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Her interview was engineered by Bob Leadham. After a short break, we'll talk with Lindsay Zaltman. He's the author of the book Marketing Metaphoria and has advice for cities that are looking to brand themselves successfully. I'm Carol Coletta. With me is our producer, Scotty Iseri, and we're trying to encourage podcast listening.
We have a great podcasting audience. We have thousands of people that download our show every week. And we thought, since we have all these smart people that are sending us comments, maybe they'd like to talk to each other. So we have this social networking site called My City, and we'd like to invite you, the podcasting listener, to join us online.
It's so valuable to me, and not only in producing the show, but in doing the work I do at CEOs for Cities, to hear from people who are on the ground in cities all over the world, what's going right in those cities, what concerns them about their cities, how cities are meeting challenges in ways that are unexpected that more people need to know about. So I would love for people to get to know each other through My City, but I'd like to know what people are seeing in their cities that they think we ought to be aware of and what ought to be shared.
How selfish of you.
What can I say? But it is a great way for us to hear from listeners, and you can be so useful to us and to people all over the world who care about cities and care about making them better. So I hope you'll participate.
Shoot me an email, Scotty, Scotty, at smartcityradio.com. Scotty@smartcityradio.com, and I'll send you an invite. Join us online.
And we'll see you there. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. For the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg from Plan Edison.
Cartography was once a challenging pursuit, typically only handled by a few highly trained professionals. But now, with ever-advancing technology, map making is as easy as Google. Technological strides have put cartography into the hands of the average person. And the average person likes it. A recent article from the Globe and Mail looks at the rising tide of amateur map makers who are taking advantage of free online mapping technology from Microsoft and Google. They've created their own mashups of maps and spatial data on such various topics as crime reports, good local restaurants, and even the location of public toilets. But while the amount of maps being created today is exponentially larger than what it was only a few years ago, many cartographers and geographers worry that untrained mapmakers could lead to a plague of inaccurate maps. And in New Orleans, officials continue to struggle with the city's cleanup and revival since the devastation of Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Many have called the aftermath of Katrina an opportunity to redevelop the city into a more sustainable urban place. A recent editorial in New Orleans City Business argues that the rush to redevelop could create a huge scar on the city, as derelict buildings and urban blight are demolished to make room for redevelopment. Officials should be wary about destroying too much of the city's historic character. Nearly 200 demolition permits were approved during a two-week window following the recent Hurricane Gustav, and the editorial claims that new standards and oversight are needed before the wrecking ball claims too much of New Orleans' culture and history. And finally, in Mexico, police corruption is widespread and notorious. Rising gang violence of late has put this corruption in the spotlight as one of the nation's most challenging problems. But officials may be onto a solution. The Associated Press reports that state officials in Michoacán are hoping to battle unscrupulous behavior in the police force by turning officers into homeowners. More than 4,000 local and state officers and prison guards will become eligible for affordable mortgages, which their current salaries can't possibly pay for. The government has partnered with a home builder to make these mortgages available in hopes that giving officers a physical stake in their communities will deter harmful criminal activity. The officers will have to pass background checks to qualify for the mortgages, which officials hope to branch out into other Mexican states. But some critics say offering mortgages to low-level officers may not do much to stem corruption, as much of the problem lies in the upper ranks. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Lindsay Zaltman is the managing director of the research and consulting firm Olson Zaltman Associates. He's discovered the use of 7 comparisons that people make regarding their consumer activity. He calls these comparisons deep metaphors, and he explains them in his book, Marketing Metaphoria. The book dissects the way consumers think about what they buy, from food to finance, and even the city where they live. Lindsay, what is a deep metaphor?
All right. Well, a deep metaphor is basically a fundamental unconscious viewing lens that we all use. We talk a lot about consumers in the field I'm in, but all of us people, you and I included, use these deep metaphors or these viewing lenses to help experience and understand the world around us. And so there's about 16 or so of these deep metaphors. And in our latest book out, Marketing Metaphoria, we refer to the 7 giants, the 7 most common of these frames. But they're unconscious in the sense that we're not aware we're using them, but they're very powerful ways to help brands communicate intended messages to consumers. They're powerful ways for consumers to understand a brand or a product or a service's needs. And in the case of the topics that you wrestle with, it's a great way for a city or a region or an area to be able to communicate and or understand what consumers think of that region. And so they come from embodied cognition and how we see them coming to life in regular language is through the use of what we call surface metaphors. These ideas, these metaphors that are in our everyday conscious thought, we use about 5 to 6 metaphors per minute in the English language and most Western languages. We use them all the time to talk about things. So we might say, my home is my cocoon. I'm dragging today. I flew across town. This city has a pulse to it. Those kind of ideas, each of those surface metaphors that are in our conscious level thought express some deeper frame. And so when you say, I'm off kilter or I'm out of whack, you're expressing this surface expression of this deeper idea of balance, one of these 16 fundamental frames.
You make the point, and I completely agree with you, that marketers get seduced by differences and they over-segment because we're always looking for how people are different so that we can produce yet another tiny tweak in the product and call it something else, rebrand it. And we rarely look for the ways in which people are similar. You tell me, what's the problem with this focus on differences?
Well, I think you summarized it well. It's what we call the seduction of differences. It is much easier for people to notice differences. You tend to notice much more easily gender differences in people, age differences, ethnic differences. It's just the way we work as humans at an unconscious level. It's much easier to process differences than it is similarities. The problem is you get caught up in those and you only start to see male versus female or young versus old, these sort of ideas, instead of looking at it at a very deeper human level. What is it in common that these people have? And we do it all the times for brands around the globe and doing it for major corporations, figuring out what is it that a teenager in Kansas and a senior citizen in France think and feel about using the computer at a very fundamental, deep level. There is something that they share. That computer is a resource for them to accomplish things or to explore the world. Now, what they might be accomplishing or exploring might be different, but at a deep level, that computer is the same type of resource for them. And so in almost every case and almost every study we've done on just about every topic there is to do, it is always these deeper universal ideas that are more powerful to engage consumers with in whatever the communications is than it is to focus on differences. And the problem with focusing on differences, if you take a city, for example, promoting itself as different things to different stakeholders, the problem is it then becomes multiple things to multiple stakeholders. There's not one idea or one position that that region stands for in consumers' minds. The best way to do it is to find out what it is very deep level that's driving all of those people to this region, and then talk about it again and maybe subtle differences to the different stakeholders. But again, it's the same idea that you're positioning around.
You said earlier that there are about 16 deep metaphors. There are 7 giants. What are those 7 giants?
We have transformation, connection, control, container, journey, balance, and I'm drawing a blank on the last one. I'll have to think. Resource was the other one. I apologize there.
Tell me more about connection, which sounds as if it could certainly apply to a city. How could a marketer, and perhaps especially someone selling a city, use connection to sell its products?
Connection's a hugely powerful one, and actually a great one for this particular case as well. We have different themes of connection in every different topic. Because there's only 16 or so of these fundamental frames, they come up in connection may come up in talking about what it's like to be a mom, what it's like to market a certain city, what it's like to enjoy drinking coffee. The importance are the themes that come up for these particular metaphors in the context of that category. And for a city, I imagine there's some sort of connection to the community as well as the larger region as well as globally. What are those connections that that region can facilitate for its residents? You can also imagine that certain regions or places have a personal connection to people. It's that place that just speaks to me, or I feel at one with it, or I'm just bonded to my city, or I'm bonded to my vacation destination that I go to every year. Those are surface metaphors that talk about people having a very strong bond or connection to a certain region. And certainly cities can market that. It can be a connection to the outside world or to the rest of the world, or it can be about bringing people in. And you can also be disconnected from a region as well. If your region is too far off in isolation, or perhaps the perception is that it's too far off in isolation from other important strategic reasons, you might want to let people know that in this day and age, actually, you can be connected quite easily to those other regions.
Well, it feels like each of these deep metaphors you describe can cut both ways. They can be positive, they can be negative. I'm trying to understand, make the leap for me on how a marketer would use these deep metaphors to not only understand behavior, but move behavior. In other words, if I'm trying to get more people to come to Pittsburgh, how might I use these deep metaphors to help me do that?
I think in the case of Pittsburgh, just speaking from my own opinions about the city, the region certainly is going through a transformation right now. A transformation is another one of these deep metaphors. It is not the old steel town that a lot of people still perceive it to be. It is actually, you know, progressing, moving forward, which is a journey metaphor, transforming into some new city. And they're focusing a lot on where they want the city to go in that sense. And so when you just think very basically with just any communications on the branding websites or the actual tagline, as I referenced with Las Vegas, they actually use surface metaphors in their tagline to cleverly communicate a more unconscious frame that they want to elicit in consumers. It can be in the brochures you send out. Certainly, whenever public officials are out speaking at conferences, they should be using language around transformation, transformative. It's a changing society. It's a changing city. It's evolving. Those are all surface metaphors to talk about this deeper idea of transformation. So I think certain regions or certain cities need to say, okay, what one or two or three of these deep metaphors are we about? And, you know, I think in Pittsburgh's case, my immediate interpretation is it's, you know, this transformation on this journey. We're taking a new path somewhere else. And so I think just being very smart about every piece of communication, every discussion you have with stakeholders out there should all be using language around this. Whether it's language or the visual imagery in brochures or on websites, it should all be communicating these ideas.
I'm curious, we're in a political season, so how do deep metaphors relate to politics, relate to this notion of conservatives and progressives? Is there a relationship?
Without a doubt. And there's some brilliant politicians out there using very smart, purposeful language around ideas. Just talking about tax relief versus tax burden, those are strategic metaphors used. The war on terror is another way that folks have framed that war to make it more politically correct, in a sense. You're doing a war on terror. Who doesn't want a war on terror? And so there's those ideas out there. They use, in just about every political speech you give, you can see that they're using very purposeful language. Typically, Republicans have been very smart about the language they use, and Democrats are now very quickly coming to own some very smart language as well. But that's an interesting battle, if you will, behind the scenes of who uses what language to talk about issues and who gets out there first to claim rights to some of these terms like tax relief or tax burden. The death tax is another one that was very smartly coined to get these perceptions out there to activate certain ideas in consumers' minds.
If you were doing some work for a city, and I know this is spur of the moment, but if you were asked to do work for a city, is that the kind of question you would ask? What does it feel like living in Pittsburgh?
I think that would be a very good one to ask people who currently live in Pittsburgh if you're trying to retain them. You might also ask a more broad question such as your thoughts and feelings about what you want out of city living or what you want out of a region or your thoughts and feelings about the role of your particular city in your life. These are all different ways that access slightly different mental models or slightly different frames in consumers' minds. So if you think of it as more of a brand study, which would be saying thoughts and feelings about Pittsburgh, or more of a category study, your thoughts and feelings about living in a city versus the suburbs or whatever the case is. Those are all very good discussions to have. Each have very strong benefits to going one way or the other.
Well, Lindsay, thanks so much for being our guest. The book is Marketing Metaphoria, What Deep Metaphors Reveal About the Minds of Consumers, from Harvard Business Press. Your methods are interesting, so I'm glad we had a chance to talk today.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me here.
Lindsay Zaltman is the managing director of Olson Zaltman Associates and is the co-author of Marketing Metaphoria. For a link to his work, go to our website, smartcityradio.com. Our producer, Scotty Iseri, has a bad habit. He likes to talk to strangers. This week on Smart City, he's found an artist whose day job provides him with unique inspiration for his art.
Dmitry Samarov has shoulder-length, curly red hair. He's a tall, solidly built guy in his 30s. And while he's driving me around, he's explaining some of the technology in his cab.
It's a car that most likely used to be a police car, because that's what these cab companies buy for cheap, because the police retire them early. So like a new cab, what's called a new cab here, unless it's privately owned, has 100,000 miles on it. Jeez. This car has 352,000 miles on it.
So how does the meter work? Like, is it connected to your odometer?
Yeah, the meter's connected to the odometer. See, there's a seal there, which is regulated by the city. You can get into a lot of trouble if you monkey with it. But mainly now, and it works on distance and time. But, if you're just stuck in traffic, it moves much slower. It's about a third as fast. But you are compensated somewhat for it.
Sometimes you just need a lift. Maybe you made a grocery store run that's too much to carry, or you've been out with friends and you don't want to stagger home. In these situations, the cab driver is your best friend. But Dmitry Samarov is not looking to make friends. To him, driving a cab just helps foot the bills for his other career.
Do I like driving a cab? Oh, it's absolutely only to make money. You know, if somebody told me tomorrow that, you know, I could make money selling my paintings and get by on it, I wouldn't drive another day. No, yeah, my big dream is to be unemployed, you know? I suppose that, yeah, if I have to have a day job, it seems like it suits me. There's no bosses, there's no coworkers. That kind of workplace politics kind of situation that arises is if cab breaks down, you know, or something, but it's pretty minimal.
Dmitry is the creator of Off Duty Hack. It's a blog and a series of books that contain stories of Dmitry's fares and drawings of his customers.
I drove in Boston from 93 to 97, moved back to Chicago in 97. Around 2000 or 2001, I decided to write about the kind of Boston experience. So the first little book was just about starting to become a cab driver.
The book contains short, typewritten descriptions of the customers, what they look like, where they went, and what type of interaction they had. Here's Dmitry reading from the latest edition of the zine.
She flapped her arms frantically, so I pulled over. She said, "Take me to 16th and Blue Island," then got back on her cell. trying to locate an Einstein's Bagels on the way. No place to get lox and bagels in her new neighborhood. It's a total wasteland, she said. Her new job pays for her to take a cab downtown because she can't be bothered to walk two blocks to the train or 100 feet across from her front door to the bus stop. She'd just broken up with her boyfriend, who was 40, European and really anal. She'd hooked up with a younger dude who was really into her, but, you know, not boyfriend material. We settled on Starbucks as a pit stop, as there are no coffee shops in Pilsen. Einstein's will open up in the neighborhood in no time. She and her kind will see to it.
To Dimitri, driving a cab is a peculiar kind of intimacy. People often share their stories with him, and sometimes much more.
People do amazing, strange things, you know? There's a one story, I think, yeah, it's in the book about these two people sharing a cab, and they didn't know each other, and, you know, within 10 minutes, they end up going home together, you know? That's just mind-boggling to me. I don't understand how that happens.
But it's the artwork that truly brings his customers to life. Dimitri depicts them in a variety of media, from pen and ink to watercolors that play with the shadows of a mechanic's garage or the dimly lit parking lot of a convenience store. They complement his brief descriptions of city life in a way that's truly beautiful. And Dimitri, from his view in the driver's seat, has a unique but brief view into the life of city dwellers.
The customer always starts these things. I never ask anybody anything aside from where they're going, you know? I figure, you know, they're paying for the ride. It's up to them whether they want silence or confessions of every deepest fear or whatever. You know, you catch people at really odd times. It's really random sometimes. You see them and you don't know where they're coming from or where they're going to. I mean, not even literally, but, you know, figuratively or emotionally or what have you. You get a very quick read on a person, you know? Every once in a while, people feel the need to unburden themselves. I guess they feel safe, you know, they'll never see you again. So they can vent about whatever it is that's bothering them. I mean, it can be a little bit of a priest confessional kind of space with that window. It definitely gives you an interesting perch to observe the humans. You know, in their ways.
For Smart City, I'm Scotty Iseri.
To see some of Dimitri's art and read selections from his zine, go to smartcityradio.com. Finally this week, one little mistake reminds City View's commentator Walker Smith that he does not, in fact, live in a bubble. He tells us how one small oversight became a stark reminder that no man is an island.
I decided to make a quick stop at a newsstand for a bottle of water as I was running out of the Tampa airport last month to get to a presentation. I had my laptop out, so my hands were full. I set my backpack down by my feet and my laptop on a stack of magazines at the register. I paid, scurried past security, hopped on the airport train, jumped into a taxi, and arrived at the threshold of my meeting to discover that I had left my laptop in the airport newsstand. For years, I have never understood how anyone could walk away from airport security without their laptop in hand. How could anyone be so dumb, I would wonder incredulously, when news stories would show the pile of laptops left behind? But here I was, dumbfounded by myself, in the lobby of the Quorum Hotel without my laptop. I'd only forgotten my laptop once before in my entire business career, and that was a minor incident barely worth note. I simply left home at the crack of dawn one day and got to airport security before I realized that I had left my laptop at home on my desk. An inconvenience, but not a crisis. On this day in Tampa, though, it was a crisis. Most infuriating was that as I was exiting the airport, I heard a page for J. Walker. Now, I go by the odd name of J. Walker Smith, So when I heard Jay Walker on the airport page without any Smith attached to it, I just dismissed it as one of those odd coincidences. Jay Walker obviously had to be someone else with a name close to mine, but surely it wasn't me. So I ignored the page. But now, in a cab speeding back to the airport, I realized that that page had indeed been for me. That's when it hit me that I was panicking over nothing. The fact that I'd been paged meant that someone had found my laptop and was trying to return it to me. I just needed to get back and answer the page, however belatedly. Sure enough, the newsstand had turned my laptop over to airport security, which was holding it for me. Two forms of government ID later, I was on my way back to the hotel to give my speech, laptop and PowerPoint presentation in hand, or actually, tucked tightly under my arm. I am used to operating under the belief that I am independent and completely self-sufficient. I have always prided myself on not being dependent on others, in particular not putting myself at the mercy of others. Yet every now and then I see what a delusion this is. Of course I am dependent on others. The very things I do to make myself independent only function at all because other people make them work. I am deeply dependent upon the support and aid of others, especially when it comes to recovering my laptop. We put a premium on the swagger of the self-made man. But it's all show. The self-made man doesn't power his own electricity or grow his own food, nor does he operate the markets in which he builds his success. In every way, he is dependent on others for the room he needs to maneuver. We must let individuals thrive, but let's not neglect the community that makes that possible. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. His latest book is Generation Ageless, and he joins us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. There's lots more Smart City to be found online. Go to our website, smartcityradio.com, and check out our links to the work of our guest, an archive of past shows, and sign up for our newsletter or podcast and get Smart City delivered directly to your inbox. If you have questions, comments, kudos, complaints, send them to us at questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. He could use a ride home if anyone's going that way. I'm Carol Coletta.